Why do I conduct my show in this manner? Mundo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mundo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here! And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. And as I speak, it is Sunday evening, August 1st, 2004, 8.06 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And normally I would be watching The Simpsons now, but it's a repeat and I've seen it already, so I don't need to bother. How are you all doing? It is... been a good week. Going to be a weekend. I was a little sick on Friday. I actually got a three-day weekend out of it because my shop was doing its annual inventory. And like an idiot, I thought it was going to occur over the weekend, so I didn't volunteer for it because I like my weekends free. And I find out just like Thursday evening that it was on Friday, so I didn't have to come in to work, although I did lose a day's pay, which sucks. And I'm a little short on cash right now. I put a little donation thing up on the website. I don't like to do that generally, but... you know, there it is, and it's up there. If you've got a few extra dollars you can spare, please feel free to donate. Go to the website, cupofjoe.blogspot.com, and click on the Make a Donation button. Donate as much or as little as you see fit. And I'm always write a thank you email in return because I very appreciate it. You know, I don't get anything from this show as far as money is concerned. Nobody pays me anything. I wish somebody would pick me up eventually, but anyway. One of the things that I like to do, as you know if you've listened to the show for a while, is to do interviews. I like doing interviews for two reasons. Number one, I like talking to people. And I just like talking to them about stuff, about working conditions. You know, and for those who have heard my interviews before, you know I don't do gotcha journalism. I'm not interested in a confrontation. I don't have right-wingers on here so that we can yell and scream back and forth at each other. Look, there's other people who do that, do it better than I do. And who can do it without getting an ulcer. And I would just get fed up. Because I get so angry with some of these right-wingers. And some of them, you know, they're so over the top. A lot of times they just say shit that they believe or that they don't even necessarily believe. They're just saying it to make a shock. But I do like to do interviews. And I like to talk to people. I used to love the old interviewers, Dick Cavett. And I'm told Jack Parr was very good. I haven't seen enough of his stuff, but I saw a little bit. But I used to love the old Dick Cavett show. And that's how I like to be, you know, just smart enough to give a kind of sort of understanding about what's going on, not afraid of celebrities, and just like to talk to people and get people comfortable and relaxed so that they're talking. And I'm trying to get more interviews. But one of the guys who was a kind of regular in the comment section and somebody I know from the Bart Cop chat room is a guy by the name of Tim Weiderquist. And he lives in Japan, and I lived in Japan for a couple of years myself, so we have some things in common there. And he is taking a nice long vacation. He teaches English in Japan, which is a good gig if you can get it. It's tough to get it. So without further ado, let's go right to it. listen to the quality of voice change as I move to the phone, and I say...
Welcome, Tim Weiderquist. That is right, right, Weiderquist?
It is Weiderquist.
Yeah, because I see it on when I email you, and I was nervous, because I know it's a German name.
And it could give you several different pronunciations. Actually, it's Swedish.
Swedish. I wasn't aware of that. It sounds German. It sounds like, you know, Weiderquist.
Right. The beginning does, and that's not so common in Swedish. But anything you see with a quist is going to be Scandinavian.
All right. Now, you grew up, where did you grow up in the States?
I grew up in West Michigan, Gerald Ford country.
Okay. Detroit area, general.
Detroit, over on the east. We're in the west, Grand Rapids, just across the border from South Bend, Indiana.
Okay. Okay, yeah, very conservative area.
Very conservative area. We have not had a Democrat represent us in Congress in my district since pre-Civil War.
Right. Now you studied to be. Now you're a teacher now. Did you want to be a teacher originally?
No, I went to college thinking I might become a minister like my father.
What? A Presbyterian?
Presbyterian minister, right. And,
you know, I just guessed that. I had no clue.
Well done.
It was the first thing that popped into my head.
Yeah, he's a Presbyterian minister, originally in the Swedish Covenant Church, but he converted to Presbyterianism around the time of the Vietnam War. He wore a black armband to church in protest of the war when we were Swedish Covenant. That's just a small little sect. And some church members complained about it, and he got out. Wasn't willing to go as far as Unitarian, but his type of activism could be accepted in the Presbyterian Church.
Did you inherit that from your father, that spirit of rebelliousness?
I did. I can remember when I was a little kid, out here in the country, we came to Michigan from Chicago because he felt, this is an odd dream, but he felt these people deserved as advanced theology as people got in the big city. And as soon as he got out here, he started working with organizing the migrant workers, because there are a lot of Mexican migrant workers as far north as Michigan, picking blueberries and strawberries in the summertime.
Right.
And trying to get publicized the fact that they were not getting services and that the large farmers were exploiting them. So even, you know, as a real little child, that's sort of been my tradition.
So despite what you hear in the U.S. news all the time, there are such things as progressive Christians, aren't there?
There are progressive Christians, but they're not loud ones, or even now he doesn't want to tell anybody how to vote.
Right.
People in this small town, they know he was active in that way, but he would never say anything political in a sermon.
Well, I think there's a difference between how religion is treated here in the South and how it's treated in some other parts of the country. Down here, in particular, they want to wear their religion on their sleeve. They think that's very important. And they're constantly saying it. And I find it, frankly, a little offensive sometimes, because I grew up in the Northeast, and while there's very heavy Catholicism and other religions, people don't come up to you every day and say, praise Jesus, after every sentence, practically.
Right.
You know, and it's a sort of thing that's kind of like, you know, it's kind of mind-numbing. But let's continue on, because I really want to get to the nature of why I wanted to have you on the show, and people are probably listening, why has he got this guy on the show? What's this got to do with anything? Now, even though you started off to become a minister, you eventually became a teacher.
Right.
Now, tell me about your experiences as a teacher. Now, Mark Satton, in his book, The Radical Middle, and I call myself the voice of the radical middle, he talks about how the biggest thing that we could do to help U.S. education is to have better teachers and to give them more leeway into the students. And what kind of experiences did you have as a teacher that turned you off to teaching here in the United States?
What kind of experiences turned me off? It's, you know, really, it's hard to know where to begin with that, because there were quite a few.
Well, give me an example that first gave you the idea that this wasn't quite what you thought it was going to be.
Just bringing one up real quickly. There was a little girl, this is kind of embarrassing, but We went out to play kickball, and I told everybody in class, this is when I first started, I was just a substitute teacher, and I don't know all these kids very well. But I tell the class, you know, we're going to go out there. I can see the kickball field's way at the other side of the playground. We're going to walk over there. We're going to be gone 30 minutes. If anybody needs to go to the bathroom, they need to go now. This is a pretty simple thing. And these were fourth grade kids.
They're about 9, 10 years old.
Yeah, so they should be able to handle something like that. Make your decision now. If you're going to go, go. I mean, that's the kind of thing you've heard that through your primary grades at school. You get to fourth grade, you should be able to figure it out. And we get out there, and there's a little girl, and Mr. Widerquist, I need to go to the bathroom. I'm like, well, you know, so you're going to have to hold it now for 25 minutes or whatever. It took us 5 minutes to walk out here. So we play our game, and we get back to class, and I didn't notice that anything was amiss. Then it's time for them to go home. And I don't really think there was anything amiss at that point. But when she got home, I guess she tells her mother I wouldn't let her go to the bathroom and she'd wet her pants. And I don't know to what level she wet. Normally, if it was bad, the kids would have really made an issue out of it. It's not the kind of thing that a teacher would miss. So the parent gets right on the phone to the principal, who gets on the phone to me, and sets up a conference the next day so that I can apologize to the parent. And that's what the principal tells me right away. You're going to have to apologize to this parent. Not because I did anything wrong, but because really I don't have any power. Because really the parent or the principal's got some power, but in the American school system, if they've got a choice to choose between a parent and a teacher, they're going to opt with the parent. And that was something that happened to me at the beginning. And there were a lot of things that reinforced that throughout my career, that my judgment on something relatively simple was not going to carry a lot of weight.
Well, let me ask, did you feel bad that the poor girl wet her pants because of that? Maybe she was just afraid to speak up afterwards?
I feel bad that it happened. And if it would have been left between she and I the next day at school, if I were her teacher, I'd say, you know, you didn't notice that, and from now on, I'm gonna make sure if we do an activity, we're gonna stay close enough that you'll be able to go to the bathroom or something. We can work it out like that. Leave it between the child and I.
Well, you were still relatively new as a teacher. I mean, how long had you been a teacher at that point?
At that point, I'd been a teacher for maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
Oh, gee, and you didn't have any supervision at all? And
no.
There was nobody there with you?
Nobody's there with me. And, you know, we got to trust people to make a decision like that. But that's not the way it works in the United States.
Well, when I first started talking to you, you mentioned about how many times that upper management would get involved with things that were going on that maybe they should have or maybe they shouldn't have gotten involved with. Now, how long did you work as a teacher here in the United States?
I was a teacher in the U.S. for 9 years.
9 years. And you constantly ran into issues like that. And a lot of stuff that I'm sure that you didn't even have direct involvement with the student for, right? Just policies and stuff that kept coming down from management?
Policies. We get to school at 8:30 in the morning, officially. Or, I'm sorry, my previous district, we got to school at 8 in the morning. And classes started at 8:30. I was pretty motivated. I mean, this was something I really wanted to do. My father had a mission as a minister. That wasn't what I wanted. I found out that I wanted to do. I didn't want to be a minister, but I wanted to have a mission. Teaching was my mission. I'd get to school at 7 o'clock, and if the principal's car was there before me, you know, then I'm going to get there at 6:55 the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But in our contract, there are some teachers that they get there at 8 o'clock. Maybe they had, you know, they had more to do in the morning. They had kids at home or something. Maybe somebody would get there at 8:05. There was never a problem, ever, with anybody not being there when the kids got there at 8:30. The contract says you get there at 8 o'clock. The school board wondered, well, what are we doing between 8 o'clock and 8:30? Because, really, our work is supposed to be teaching. You know, that's with the kids, being in charge of the kids. we're just at the school at 8 o'clock, and the kids don't get there to 8:30, so they have a professional that has preparation to do doesn't need the parents or the local business guy on the school board to tell them exactly what to do to get ready for the class. It changes every day. And we tell them, you know, we just need this time to get ready, whatever we need to get ready. And they, well, you know, you should take that home. That's homework. That's what you should do at home the day before. When you get to work, you should be working. Which, if you have a lawyer, you know, and he's going to go to trial, do you want him to just show up at the trial and start working? Or should he have been preparing whatever he's going to say for a little while before he shows up?
And nobody really likes just walking in and working immediately anyway. I mean, I don't like that. You like a couple of minutes to just get settled in, even, you know, for whatever, you know, just to get settled in, get used to your environment again, even though you go there every day.
Sure.
You don't just bell rings 8:30, you walk in and start teaching.
Right, right. They want to, you know, you're Superman. You walk in the telephone booth, you throw on your suit, boom, you're going instantly. But it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they would, sometimes they'd come through the building and they'd walk around, and there might be somebody just making coffee. You know, that's all they're doing. And that really got, this is, you know, we have to run this school efficiently. It has to be a tight ship. So they wanted, the last thing that I was a part of, I was a union rep at my last school, was negotiating what the teacher's responsibilities would be between 8 o'clock and 8:30 in the morning. And fighting as hard as I could for that to be left at the discretion of the teacher.
Well, what did they want you to do as opposed to what you needed to do for your class?
They wanted us to be meeting with students or requiring students who were behind to come in early and tutoring them. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that occasionally I would do. You can leave that to the teacher. Maybe that kid can't get in there at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's one of the things that they wanted us to do.
Yeah, the school bus is the school bus, unless they have a vehicle for themselves. And you're talking, what, elementary school kids,
elementary,
right?
Little kids.
Yeah.
They wanted us to be doing that or holding meetings as teachers, which that would just degenerate into, all right, now I have to be in the same room as Mrs. Smith and Mr. Johnson, and probably, now that they're here, we're just going to sit around and drink coffee because I can't do the work that I want to do on my own.
Right.
So,
just having meetings for the sake of having meetings.
Just for the sake of having meetings.
Even if there's nothing to talk about.
Right. Or what they would have really loved is if they could call that a break. All right, that's really, you're just taking a break, so we're going to take away little breaks you have at recess during the middle of the day.
See, that's just the type of thing I talk about with working conditions here in the States, where they always try to pull this petty little BS all the time that has really nothing to do with how things go at the workplace. It's just a matter of how much power that the management can assert over you simply because they can.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to me to be a perfect example of that. I mean, you know, it wouldn't have made any difference to your pay whether or not, because you guys like a salary, right?
Yeah.
It's not an hourly thing. So you got paid the same whether you were there at 8 o'clock or 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine they would have loved it if a teacher just showed up at exactly 8:30 and was in the classroom exactly at 8:30. Not that it made any difference. I just don't understand what their objection was to having a teacher sitting down and doing a little paperwork or making sure he's got his notes in order for the coming class. It doesn't have anything to do with helping the kids, but it seems to have everything to do with...
They have to be in control.
In control, yeah.
And tell us what to do.
Yeah, and that's like that in so many workplaces. How long did you put up with this before you finally got out?
It's all who your principal is, or, you know, in the United States, local control. We can go in a lot about the advantages and disadvantages of local control, but if you've got a good school board and a good principal, which I had for about 4 years, that was great. But then 5 years. 5 years of really just the most antagonistic relationship that a person could have.
Was that in Indiana or was that somewhere else?
That was in Illinois.
Illinois.
North suburban Illinois.
Rich neighborhood. Rich area.
Skokie, Illinois. District 73, East Prairie. If there's anybody that has a child in the East Prairie School District, please send me an email at tim@weiderquist.com, and I will advise you to do better for that child.
But is that like, what kind of area is that? Is that lower middle, upper middle?
That is an upper middle class district.
Okay, not surprising, because parents in those districts tend to pay more attention to the schools than you know, other parents, but in a very obtrusive kind of way.
Right, right.
And obviously that affects the school board and the principal as well. And that's interesting because one of the things that Mark Satin talked about was how you need to give principals more power, and sometimes that's a good thing and sometimes that's a bad thing.
Mm.
So what was the last straw? What was it that finally said, enough, I've had enough, I'm leaving? Don't have to have names or anything like that.
Okay.
And now it's not like they're going to hear the show anyway. So.
Things were extraordinarily antagonistic. I was the union rep. I sat down in a meeting. There was a teacher we had one student, just a little bit more background information. The majority of students in this district were recent immigrants. From Southeast Asia, and their parents had just made enough money that they weren't working at the 7-Eleven anymore. Maybe they'd bought it and they got a nice house in the northern suburbs. But those parents didn't have much to do with the school. It was the older parents, the European Americans that had been there for a long period of time that really had control over the school board and control over the school. There was one parent who felt that her student was extraordinarily gifted and really was skillful at saying when she was going to sue and how she was going to go about things, and had the ear of the principal and the superintendent and the school board.
You wonder why she didn't just homeschool.
Well, that wouldn't have been there can't be as many meetings about your children when you're homeschooling.
Oh,
you can have a meeting where you've got the psychologist and the gifted specialist and the principal, and they're all talking about your kid. Can you imagine how rewarding that could be for a neurotic woman? That's, you know, she'd get a lot of psychic reward from that. So her child, if he misbehaved, and I guarantee you if he'd have been interviewed by a real psychologist, somebody who really, he was interviewed by our school psychologist, but he had his political issues as well. If he misbehaved in class, we were supposed to give him a visual cue at first, and that would be to raise our hand to him. The teacher would raise their hand at the child, just to warn him that we're going to talk to him. Then following that, we were supposed to give him a verbal warning, and then following that, if that didn't work, we could have him leave the classroom. We could send him down to work with a specialist. However, one of our teachers had this child in class. She was a fifth grade teacher, and the kindergarten reading buddies were going to come up, and they're going to read with the class. And so the fifth grade students who's got the behavior problem and the strong mom says, I don't want those fucking kids coming up here anymore. I'm sick of that stupid little fucker.
Those exact words. Oh, my goodness.
And so now at this point, the teacher is supposed to give him the visual clue, then wait, see if that works, give him another verbal clue. If that doesn't work, then ask him to leave the room. But she's like, you know, she's worried because these little kids are coming up, and they're cute, and they're nice kids. So she's like, you go to the computer lab and ask Mr. Stevens if he'll let you get on the Internet. All right? So that's his consequence for using the F word twice in class and calling his kindergarten reading buddy stupid.
Yeah, if I had said anything like that when I was going to school, you know, I would never have heard the end of it.
Right, and I wouldn't have either, but we were right. This was a bad situation. all power had been taken from the teachers regarding this child. So then when he gets home, he tells his mother, you know, yeah, I got sent to the computer lab today, and I didn't get the visual cue, and I didn't get the verbal cue. Well, we had on record a contract that the child's behavior contract, and the teacher had signed this contract saying that she would give him the visual cue and the verbal cue. And so the parent, this was, the parent did not have a good relationship with the teacher, didn't like the teacher. She got the ball rolling by calling the principal and the superintendent, and the school was going to get sued if something didn't happen about it. So the next day I'm in a meeting, and I'm all of the representation that this teacher has, because really basically I've read our contract and I know that, you know, what the union can do in certain situations. But the union doesn't provide a lawyer. You hear all the time about how teachers' unions are so powerful and we're going to protect every teacher. All she had was one member of the staff that was relatively familiar with the contract sitting beside her. And the principal and the superintendent and the district lawyer give her a document that says that she discriminates against disabled children, and that's going to go on her permanent record.
Good Lord.
And if something is not, she's going to have to take additional classes in how to deal with disabled children, and she could be terminated if this isn't corrected to the liking of the district by the end of the school year. And that was such an absolute, and I really wanted to help her, and I did as much as I could. I told them all I was disgusted by the situation, that they don't know at all what they're talking about, and really it's bad for the teacher, but it's worse for the student. So that was one of the worst things that happened that pushed me over the edge.
And once you left the U.S. school system, you just, I don't know, how did you come to the decision to go to Japan and work as a teacher in Japan?
I had a friend, luckily, who had gone over there as an English teacher, and he went over with no credential whatsoever just to get into the Japanese business market. And he kept telling me that I should try teaching in Japan for a while because I'd get some respect. I was sending him emails all the time that, you know, things were deteriorating at school. And he kept saying, you ought to come over to Japan and see what it's like. Come over to Japan and see what it's like. So I decided I would give it a try. And I went over just on a tourist visa, but found a school that was willing to sponsor a working visa. That can be a difficult thing to earn. And I've been working at two different universities for the last 5 years.
Now you're teaching college-level students.
Now I'm teaching college-level students.
Did you ever get a chance to teach children of the same age as you taught when you were in American schools?
I teach children of that age, but I teach as a private tutor. The students that I work with are generally, their parents are going, they're Japanese kids whose parents are going to move to the U.S. and they want to bring them up to speed or have lived in the U.S. and they want to maintain their skills. So I have some interaction with Japanese schools, and that I'm working with kids that are going to Japanese school. But I have not taught in a Japanese elementary school.
Okay. Now, when you were interviewed, now you wrote about this in your little article on my blog. So tell us about the interview process, what you went through.
Met with a committee of teachers, and they asked me a series of questions. And they approved me, and then they presented me to the administration of the school, but still, as of yet, I have not met the administration at the university. I only meet, and if I have problems, I go to other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So we work cooperatively.
So what does the administration do if they don't monitor the teachers and exercise control the way they do here in the States?
In education, we talk about administration and management, and they see themselves more in, like, physical management of the school, that they make sure that we've got an overhead projector, and they make sure that the budget, you know, and that the physical plan is maintained. But in the classroom, the teacher is really expected to be a specialist, and they're a specialist at managing things physically, so they can't really tell us what to do in the classroom. That's the way they see it. So it's a completely different system.
But also, you know, it would seem to me, having lived in Japan for a couple of years, it would seem to me that you would have less of a behavioral problem, especially when you're talking about college students in Japan than you would in the United States. I mean, kids, there's no sense in just beating around the bush. Kids are spoiled rotten here. And they're expected the world to be handed to them. And the Japanese are just different about that. I mean, they work hard. They work hard to get to college. So by the time they get up there, it seems to me that they're all pretty much, you know, crazied out, although I know they do their share of partying on college campuses.
They work really hard to get in, and they're expected to get through. So we don't push them that hard. But when they're in the classroom, whatever you ask them to do, it's going to get done. It might take them a long time. They might work slowly, and they might. It's such a different thing. They might not do it exactly the way you want because they're used to getting so much direction in junior high and high school and their cram schools after school. It's hard for a Western teacher. We give them, like, what we want at the end, but they'll try to get to that. They might not do it the way we want.
Right. They're more used to, they're not as freewheeling thinkers
as
we can be. What is the phrase in Japan? The nail that sticks out gets hammered down?
Right. The nail that sticks out that gets hammered down. But everybody does what the teacher says.
Right.
I mean, there is no disruption. There could be, on occasion, I've seen somebody with their cell phone under the desk or something. But really quiet, and then if they get busted, they're really embarrassed.
Could you give me an example of a big difference between American students and Japanese students?
Okay, when I first started teaching in Japan, I went into a classroom, and I gave them paper, and I said, you know, pass it back, everybody take one. And they were expected to read it, and then I was going to ask them some questions. It's a good idea to let them read something before you ask them to speak. I teach English speaking. And gave them a little time to read it, and I started asking questions, and a couple kids in the front were able to give me answers, and there were some guys in the back. I asked them, and I got no answer. And so I told them to think about it, look for the answer, and I'll call on them again in a minute. And there's a long list of questions. I call on some kids in the front again, and they give me the correct answer. And I think, you know, this isn't too hard. I'll go back to the back and let the guy in back, you know, get one right. He'll fully feel good. I give him a really easy question. He still can't give me the answer. And I'm like, you know, what's the matter? All right. I tell him, I'll let you know. I'm going to ask you another question, so make sure you read this. And so I ask a few more questions in the front. I get to a question. He's just got to know this next one. And I ask him in the back. He still does not know the answer. So I walk back there, like, what's going on? And he's, oh, sensei, there's no paper here. And not I didn't give him paper. He says, there is no paper here. But really, I hadn't given the class enough paper. They ran out.
Oh.
It's supposed to go to the back. And this kid, the teacher can't be so wrong as to not hand out enough paper.
Right.
There's got to be some other global problem, like there's not enough paper in the world.
See, sensei can never be wrong.
The sensei did not screw up and not give them enough paper. They wouldn't say that to me. They said, no, there's not enough paper here. But really, I felt terrible. You know, I kept calling. In America, it would have been, dude, you did not give us the paper right off the bat. But I don't have to worry about that in Japan.
Well, that's kind of built into the way they are. I mean, from what I was told by Japanese parents, they said they basically spoil their kids until they start school. Because once the school starts, then they're just totally disciplined.
Yeah. You do this. They know what's going to be on the test, and they have just out and out got to master it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're given directions in the cram school. Everything is set up, and it's assumed that everybody's going to make it. Some do and some don't, but they lay it out so that, you know, everybody at least is going to give it a max effort.
Let me ask you this. I mean, there are a lot of good things to say about the Japanese education system, and obviously I do not think a lot of stuff is going to work here in the States if, you know, you talk about transferring what they do over there over here, because we don't have that sense of total discipline that they have. But do you think that maybe sometimes they're a little too disciplined and that they don't give enough chance for someone to develop what their own personal skills might be?
Yeah, and that might even be putting it lightly, that, you know, they're given a test that's going to get them into high school, they're given a test that's going to get them into college, and there's always a right and a wrong answer for every question on those tests. You know, it's a lot of math, and the history questions aren't, it's never why do you think, or give a good explanation of. It's always, you know, this is the correct answer that you have to write, so that they're quite a ways behind in forming their own opinions and giving their own answer. In English classes in high school, the teachers, you know, every word in the sentence has to be in the correct order. It's to that level before the answer can be right. Whereas that's not really communication, but that is just the way that they study. We had when we learn writing in the United States, we're learning how to write an introduction, support, and then a conclusion. But in Japanese, they're really learning to memorize all these different characters and the different meanings that those characters could have. But when they learn writing, they're not learning how to logically put together an argument. And even Japanese people will admit this, that there is the structure between a good essay and a bad essay in Japan just really doesn't exist. It's really a better essay is something that might evoke a feeling, or usually it's something that's written by a respected author.
Is there a sense that the Japanese are slowly changing, or are they still the same way they were? How long have you been teaching there, by the way?
I've been teaching there for 5 years, and in that time I feel like it's not that long, but I've seen a difference in the students.
You think the Japanese are going to start going through their 60s pretty soon? Because I think they were going through, when I was there in the 80s, to me it seemed like the 50s in terms of, you know, their service and how they did things. Like you go out to the gas station and everybody would yell, you know,
all right, all right, all right.
Yeah, yeah. And,
yeah.
That's the way it used to be in the States. You know, my father would tell me that, you know, you go, they'd run out and they check your oil, they'd fill the gas up for you. Self-serve gas was like, huh? Nobody did that, you know.
Right, right.
But the Japanese were going through that, and I thought, you know, the Japanese sooner or later are going to have to go through their 60s. I mean, the discipline is great, and it does a lot of good things, but people can't keep that stuff up forever. So, yeah, I think they still have to go through that area. I mean, it just seems to be that they can't keep up that discipline forever.
I don't know if they have to go through a 60s, but they have to do something to become more creative. I think at least within Japanese universities, that's definitely one of the big issues. We have to build creativity, and we have to make students more expressive. And I think in families and the general culture, there's that feeling also. But how to do it is a difficult question. Right now, young Japanese workers are going through a big change. A lot of them are choosing to become what they call freeders, and freeder is a short version of English free time. And what they do is, rather than going to work at a big company right away, they'll work in retail or at a gas station or something for maybe 6 months. Then they'll stop when they've got it, as soon as they got enough money for 2 months, and they're just going to live at the beach or they'll travel for 2 months. And then they'll come back and they'll get another sort of part-time job that they'll just work for another 6 months. And people will go 20-year Japanese people in their 20s, a lot of them are in this cycle, and they're not going right for the big company job.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's expressing themselves and what they want out of life. You know, they want to see things. They want time for themselves. They're not just going to follow every little rule that you're supposed to go to the best high school that you can, go to the best university that you can, get in the best company that you can, start making kids.
Right. That's kind of a drone mentality that some people have in this country. I mean, that's all there is. You know, grow up, go to school, get a job, get married, pump out a few more units and repeat.
Mm.
And it seems to me like a lot of the Japanese kids are starting to reject that.
Right. And this Frieder lifestyle has got the 50s, 60s, the middle-aged people kind of up in arms. They think that's really weird.
Yeah, we worked hard all our lives. You guys are just goofing off.
You're just goofing off. This can't be right. Our society is falling apart. But it's possible that they're just breaking that chain. I think that, you know, there's going to be a time when they're going to want a few of the better things in life. I mean, most people in the United States do, where, you know, they go through that for a little while, and they settle down, all right, this is the career, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to do it, and they can end up often making decent money doing it or being part of a company that does it, but the continuity will come out when you decide what you want to do.
Right. Just searching for something, basically. Something.
And then I imagine, you know, the way that they're living their lives in their 20s, they're probably going to raise their kids a little bit different, too. And that could be the way things change.
Let me ask this, because there's a growing feeling among some of us here in the United States, despite the divisiveness that's currently going on between countries, and obviously the U.S. has had a lot to do with that in the last 3 years or so, there's kind of a feeling that the world is slowly but surely starting to come together into a full global community. President Clinton talks about that when he talks about having a worldwide society based upon our shared humanity. Do you think the Japanese have any sense of that yet? Because the Japanese have been a very insulated society. Even when they've been open economically, they're still very closed. I mean, I could say one of the things I enjoyed about being a foreigner hanging out in Japan is that I can get away with damn near anything, because gaijin are considered along the same lines with children and mental retards. You know, they can do anything because they fit outside their social structure. But is there any sense that Japanese are beginning to understand that they're part of a global community, or are they just as insulated as they ever were?
Yeah, man, you know, that's a big question, and one that I want to ponder some.
See, I don't ask small questions on this show. I always ask the big questions.
This is where people come to think through the real issues. My gut feeling would be that, yes, there is that sense, because the younger, the people, I work with kids that are in university, and if you ask them who their favorite music is, so often it's Western, or what type of career they want, so often it's something that doesn't fit the Japanese mold, it's more Western. Certainly, where do they want to go? They want to get out and see the world more than the Japanese person of 40 or 50 years ago that I've read about. But there are 120 million of them over there, all speaking the same language, kind of still afraid of that outside world, the people that don't take 2 showers a day, and
yeah, they're very clean. They're unbelievably clean.
Right. And, you know, don't even like to use a toilet seat that hasn't been
sanitized
and heated, and, you know, they have some things that really make them Japanese and they really like.
Well, that's fine, because there are obviously some things that make me American. Like little things, like when I was over there, I used to put soy sauce in my rice. And I was told, no, a Japanese person would never do that. And it's like, well, I'm not Japanese, I'm American. This is the way I like my rice. I like to have a little flavoring in it. I can't just eat it bland, you know. Mm. And hopefully the Japanese are getting a little bit more individualistic. Let me ask you about working conditions. Not so much about dealing with the students, but among your fellow teachers and stuff like that. How do they treat you? What is the atmosphere like when you on those times when you work with them?
It's so much more. The first word that jumps into my mind is relaxed. People say that it's there and that I'll see it. If I were part of the Japanese staff, they have these groups that are cliques that work together and share information. But in America, I mean, everybody I felt like was looking to stick me in the back.
And stick each other in the back.
Right, and stick each other in the back. And maybe, you know, who could get up with the administration and move me down a little bit or move themselves up. Whereas in Japan, it's more like we're on the same team. You know, we all work at the same place. I have read about people that have a harder time, that they feel like they can never really become part of the Japanese organization, and that's very frustrating. But a lot of times I think, you know, they haven't worked in the United States long enough, and I haven't felt lacking in that way myself. I just feel it's a much more relaxed situation.
And there's not people like who are suspicious of you because you're an American and whatnot, or because you're a foreigner in general.
There's one secretary that maybe thinks, I don't know, but it's not nearly that bad. I know one guy that had a hard time with her, but she doesn't like to have to try to bend her. See, in the United States, we're used to people speaking crappy English all the time.
Hang on, you're breaking up. Are you on a cordless phone?
Yes, I am.
Can you maybe change phones?
Yeah, just a second. Got to get upstairs.
Yeah, it's breaking up. I can hear it's all crackling and getting like.
Okay, does it still sound bad?
A little better. There you go. That's much better now.
Okay, this is much better?
Yeah.
Okay. In the United States, or no, in Japan, no, I'm sorry, let me start again. In the United States, we're used to people speaking a little bit crummy English because we have so many immigrants around. You might run into somebody with a Spanish accent or a Russian accent, or somebody that doesn't know all the idioms that you know, and you can still... you communicate with them.
Right.
But in Japan, you know, only 1.5% of the people are immigrants, and most of them speak very good Japanese. So they're just not used to people like myself who don't have very strong language skill. And so there's a secretary or two that really just don't like to hassle with that very much.
Right.
And other people have said, well, that's, you know, it's because you're a foreigner. And I think maybe it's because my language skill is so weak. But, you know, maybe it's because I'm a foreigner. But there is one person that I feel doesn't like to work with me that much. But
is it also a sense of, for the Japanese, like when they do speak English, I've heard, and I don't know if I've experienced it very much, but that if they can't speak it properly, they won't speak it at all.
That's absolutely the case. In some situations, one that's very common is a cab driver, that if you're in a big city or any place that's got a cab, you get in and say very simply, for example, Meguro Eki, and I'm 100% certain that my Japanese is perfect when I'm saying something that short. That's just a very well-known train station. That's where I want to go.
Right.
And he'll look around at me and wave his hand in a way that says, no, I don't speak English. But I'm not speaking English. I'm speaking Japanese.
You're just not speaking it as well as a Japanese person would.
Right. And maybe it's just that I'm white. That could be, maybe I'm getting some discrimination.
Well, I think it would be worse if you were black. I know the Japanese feel just as strongly about race as we do here.
Yes.
I've had experience with that. Japanese and Koreans and blacks do not get along. It's just a very interesting aspect of it. But I know a lot of Japanese like to work on that. So, I don't know. It's a very interesting type of deal. But I do think that if there's a glimmer of hope for Japanese to break out of their insulation and join the rest of the world, or have the rest of the world join Japan, which might not be such a bad thing, then there's a glimmer of hope for everybody.
Right.
Really, because I think even the most fanatic of believers in their own culture are eventually going to come around to thinking, well, you know, unless I plan on killing everybody that's against me, we're all going to learn to live together.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I need to cut this to an end, because we've been talking close to an hour now. So, it's the type of conversation I could sit there and record for 4 or 5 hours, but obviously we only have an hour for the show. So, Tim, let me let you go. Let me thank you for being on the show. And I'm glad. Oh, before I do that, let me explain to people why you aren't being able to talk to you in the first place, because you work in Japan, but you're here in the U.S. on vacation, right?
That's right. I am on vacation.
Now,
vacation.
How long, how many months of vacation do you get a year?
I get 3 months of vacation a year.
3 months of vacation.
3 months. That's not 3 days. That's not 3 weeks. That's
right.
3 months.
You know, as I like to point out, you know, to people in my shop, I said a private in the U.S. Army gets more vacation time than a 25-year veteran of the place where I work. We get 23 days. If you work there for 25 years, you get 23 paid vacation days a year. That's less than a month. And you get 3 months.
3 months.
And if you go to Germany, you're talking 6 weeks. If you go to Italy and France and Spain or all those places, you get 6 to 8 weeks per year.
Mm.
And actually, you know, the private thing in the Army is kind of misleading, because even the highest-ranking NCO in the Army, highest-ranking sergeant, gets the same amount as a private. But still, it says something there that a company, and I work for Siemens, which is a big international company, no small bones, and a union shop to boot, that we get so little vacation time. And I hear Americans complain about this all the time. And I remember that we have too much vacation time and we don't work hard enough. And I'm like, what are you guys, nuts? You know, if you're not working 60, 80 hours a week, it seems like you're nuts. And the Japanese used to have that reputation. But now, I begin to look like the Japanese are like, you know, slackers compared to the way we are.
I think the Americans look, they want to call somebody else hardworking so that they can motivate the American worker to work more. Look, you don't work as hard as the Japanese.
Hmm.
But I don't think there's that much to it. Another thing, very quickly, I want to point out that's related to that is that you'll often hear people say, if anybody is in a school district that's thinking about lengthening the school year, they'll talk about how little American students go to school. And that those numbers are inaccurate. The reason that I have this much time off is because the Japanese school year is that much shorter. We get 2 months off in the summer, we get a month off in the spring, and then there are vacation days throughout the year. The Japanese kids have a much shorter school year than we do. And American kids, it's creeping longer and longer and longer every year, and it does not necessarily mean that they're going to achieve more.
And we've been talking about here about how much more homework kids get now than they used to.
Right. Everybody's got to work more. I mean, everybody's got to work more unless they are maybe in the administration. Those people need a little time off.
Yeah.
That's the culture.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for being on my show.
It's been a great honor. Thank you very much.
I know you're going to be very busy on this vacation, busy having fun. I'd still very much, if you ever get a chance to come down here to Atlanta, you should come to, maybe next year you can come down here if you can't do it this time around.
Okay.
But Tim, thanks for being on the show, and take care.
Thank you so much. All right, bye-bye.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
Welcome back to the BuzzFlash.com GOP Hypocrite of the Week. It's now official. What we all suspected has become crystal clear. The mainstream news media is a big-time enabler to the vast right-wing conspiracy. The decision by the mainstream networks to barely give coverage to the Democratic National Convention enabled the Republicans to continue to define Kerry and the Democrats in the absence of network exposure to an alternative perspective. An impassioned, positive, inclusionary vision was articulated over four nights, yet Dan Rather says he'd get better ratings airing a test pattern. Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings are all in agreement. There's no news to be had at the Dem convention. You know, perhaps Dan Rather should be replaced by a test pattern. It sure would be cheaper than that bunch of tired old superannuated corporate shills. Rather, Brokaw, Jennings, and their ilk know that Viacom, GE, and Disney sign the paychecks for their big, fat, multi-million dollar salaries. They know that by restricting the public's exposure to the Democrats' most articulate convention in years, they will be able to continue to report GOP-manufactured news about flip-flopping candidates and opinionated women. It is simply beyond disgusting. And while the all-news cable networks decided to spend more time covering the convention, most of it was spent trashing the Dems, repeating Republican soundbites, and talking over the speeches with fatuous, biased punditry. Who has time to discuss the Democrats' new policy ideas or how they plan to move the nation forward when their 5 minutes on CNN is spent rebutting GOP-sponsored lies and talking points dutifully regurgitated by Wolf Blitzer? Kerry has his work cut out for him. He's running against Bush and the media. As the documentaries Outfoxed and Orwell Rolls in His Grave confirms, the news divisions of the networks and of cable television are just extensions of the corporate politics of their owners. The Democrats can't start a conversation about the lies of Bush and the Republicans because Republicans own and run the media conglomerates that control the echo chamber. In just one of many examples, on Wednesday night and Thursday, the television GOP corporate news shills were blabbering on about Kerry being a flip-flopper again. This is only because the GOP, quote, response team, unquote, in Boston released a videotape of Kerry talking about his views on the Iraq War. Yet, no one who reads BuzzFlash can think of a single commentator who mentioned that Bush declared himself a war president one day and a peace president the next, or that many people who initially supported Bush's invasion of Iraq did so because Bush lied about Iraq's WMDs and Iraq's connections to Al-Qaeda. But for the mainstream media, it's more important that Kerry changed his mind when he discovered Bush lied, than that nearly 1,000 Americans died fighting in Iraq because of Bush's lies. Hey, if it's not a GOP attack message point of the day, Dan, Tom, and Peter don't consider it news. So, to the millionaire megaphones for the GOP, who presume to call themselves journalists, we present you with the dubious honor of being designated the BuzzFlash GOP Hypocrites of the Week. Until next week, remember our motto at BuzzFlash.com. So many Republican hypocrites. So little time. Catch up with you soon.
And I got about 10 seconds here, so thanks, BuzzFlash. Thanks, Tim Widerquest. And don't forget the website, cupojoe.blogspot.com. Till next time, bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.